I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 26th of November. Right versus left in the Midwest. The New York Times Sunday Review section had an opinion piece by Professor Lawrence Jacobs. He's been with us before. He's a professor of political science at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota and author of Healthcare Reform and American Politics. He says that Minnesota and Wisconsin have quite a bit in common, the bone-chilling winters, German and Northern European roots, and until recently, modern progressivism. But in 2010, the states diverged. What has happened in Minnesota with the election of one of the most progressive governors in the nation, Mark Dayton, and in Wisconsin with Scott Walker, who Professor Jacobs describes as a bold and vigorous Republican? We'll talk about the article and what he found in both states this hour of the program. Welcoming your phone calls, I would imagine we'll have more than a few on this issue. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Jacobs, thanks so much for being with us again. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. This article has created a bit of a stir, as you can well imagine. It's all over the web, sir, but you probably know that.
You know, to be honest with you, I haven't been kind of staring in the mirror and following it, but my students and colleagues and friends have been shooting me kind things and some nice challenges, so it's
yeah,
interesting.
I would imagine. Before we get to what's happened since 2010, can you talk a little bit about how that election happened? It is interesting with all the similarities that you outlined that we've gone such divergent political paths. Why is that?
Well, you know, I think it's been a series of pretty close elections. In Minnesota, the 2010 election that brought Mark Dayton, the Democrat, to the governor's mansion was one of our closest elections. It had a recount and made national news. Scott Walker won clearly by a bit more, but it was still a pretty competitive election. So you've got these close elections, but each party, the Democrat and Republican, have now become, increasingly, I would say, homogenous. That is, one is much more liberal and the other is much, much more conservative. So close elections produce these huge policy differences.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with taxes. Minnesota raising taxes by $2.1 billion. You say the largest increase in recent history. Democrats introducing the fourth highest income tax bracket in the country and targeting that 1% to pay quite a huge percent of new taxes. Was this done? What were the reasons for doing this? And was it done with a great deal of enthusiasm and support from people who live in Minnesota?
It was done because the Democrats came in and said that the previous governor, Tim Pawlenty, who's a Republican, had underinvested in education and other necessary needs. And so they really, increased taxes. There was a tremendous debate, though the debate started off about what kind of tax, not whether they would go up. And the governor had first come out with a pretty sweeping property tax reform that would widen what was taxed to clothing and internet and a lot of business services, and then lower that property tax rate. There's a fairly broad group of economists and other types who like that approach, think it's more efficient, and that's not necessarily along party lines. But there was a big backlash across the business community against it, and the Democrats in the legislature in 2013 said to the governor, no way, we're not going to do that. So he had to back off, and then they went back really pretty hard to the income tax side.
Mm-hmm. In terms of growth of the economy, Wisconsin, as you cite in the article, Governor Walker had promised 250,000 private sector jobs in his first term. A year before the next election, the number is less than 90,000 jobs. Minnesota, on the other hand, the fifth fastest growing state economy, private sector job growth exceeding pre-recession levels. Why such a stark difference?
Well, I want to answer that question, but I want to be really clear that the kinds of things we're talking about are very complicated. And I say in the piece that we would need more time and more evidence. it's not just a kind of a Weasley way to say it depends, but it really is true. So I'm going to step into very thin ice, and then if callers call in, I'll quickly make a lot of caveats about what we're going to say. But I think what we can say is that the lower tax rate that we've seen in Wisconsin hasn't produced better results in Minnesota. In Minnesota, we had 8 years of Tim Pawlenty, who really fought very effectively and skillfully to hold down the increases in state taxes. And we continue to see pretty subpar job performance. There was actually a bit of a loss of jobs under Governor Pawlenty's term. And in Minnesota, Mark Dayton comes in, and Minnesota has kind of regained its lead, certainly in the region, as a kind of jobs engine. Forbes magazine, which ranks states in terms of how friendly they are to business, ranked Minnesota as the 8th best state for business in the country. Wisconsin, it's very little bit, but it's well in the bottom half of states and has kind of been locked in that area.
Mm-hmm. And have people embraced this because they realize what's happened with job growth in Minnesota? Is this governor wildly popular now?
I would say he's popular, and maybe some would say surprisingly popular. He's not nearly as charismatic, for instance, as Governor Walker. But he's very authentic. So his approval ratings, they're not sky high, but they're in the 50s. I think a lot of the issues we're talking about are actually pretty controversial. People don't like their taxes to go up, of course. But there also seems to be pretty strong support for putting a lot of that money into education and job growth.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about education. How much of that money went into job education and what kind of – or into education and what kind of education?
Yeah, this is very important. That $2.1 billion, which is a huge amount for Minnesota, a good part of that, about half of it, immediately went into reducing the deficit and then for trying to reduce property taxes. So you've got that remaining pile of money. And 71% of it was put into education, obviously K-12 education, that is the kindergarten through 12th grade. But also we saw quite a bit going into higher education. And then a first all-day kindergarten in Minnesota. Mm. And there was an increase in funding for early childhood education, which has gotten a lot more attention from economists as an important and smart investment in terms of the return for job growth in the economy.
And contrast that with what happened in the state of Wisconsin in terms of education.
Yeah, in terms of education, again, K-12, the Walker administration reduced K-12 spending by 15%. That's the 7th sharpest decline in the country. By the way, all these numbers I'm mentioning, the Times was very kind in including a bunch of links to some of the studies that I was drawing on. So these are hard numbers, and if any of your listeners are interested, they go track them down themselves.
The other big difference is in terms of health care, and as we continue debating the Affordable Care Act and what states are doing, there was a very different response to the Affordable Care Act. What was Minnesota's response? What was Wisconsin's response?
Well, in Minnesota, Governor Dayton expanded Medicaid under the new law, which pays 100% of the cost for the first 3 years and then 90% after that. And it brought in 35,000 folks who had been not covered in the past. In addition, the governor set up a state health insurance exchange where you've got private, nonprofit insurers competing for business. Subsidies are provided for the uninsured whose incomes are 94,000 or so and below. So it's a pretty comprehensive set of subsidies. So far, Minnesota is keeping very close to its target that it laid out way before we got into the rollout starting October 1. Of course, there's been a lot of problems in Washington. Things seem to be a little better, but the October 1 launch was a disaster. But Minnesota is one of the states that did it on its own, taking advantage of that discretion that the state had.
which means that it's how many people signed up for this? A very large number when compared to other states, right?
Yeah, Minnesota is one of the kind of leading states in terms of the numbers that are signing up. Obviously, we're not a huge state like California, which is signing up 2,000 people a day. But when you look at kind of what was planned and expected, we're right up there. We're really on target, and we haven't had the kind of sustained problems we've seen in Washington.
Mm-hmm. You also write, though, in the article that Minnesota is a health reform pioneer, but you have problems, entrenched problems, in rural areas of the state.
You know, you listen to this, or maybe you've read the piece I wrote, and I think sometimes there's a tendency to think, oh, you know, this is a partisan. I'm actually a registered independent, and I made a good faith effort to follow the data. And I think sometimes in the exuberance, reformers tend to exaggerate some of the benefits or don't acknowledge some of the limits. And one of the real challenges in states like Minnesota and Wisconsin and others is that we've got rural areas. It's going to take some real time and maybe some concerted, targeted efforts to bring some of the benefits of the private sector and some of these new government programs to those areas. We're going to see in Minnesota that there's going to be higher medical costs compared to the rest of the state. We're probably going to see premiums relatively higher. We may even see the supply of medical providers not really being adequate to the new demand. Hmm. These are all very significant issues and require attention. And I think we just have to be honest about that and say, you know, the beginning of health reform, at least in this iteration, is not the end of the problems.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the final paragraph before we go to phone calls, because I'm sure you're going to have more than a few. Evidence and common sense should matter more in our overheated political debates. You write, the lesson from the upper Midwest is that rigid anti-tax dogma fails to deliver a convincing, optimistic vision that widens economic opportunity and security. The excesses of liberalism may lurk, but Minnesota is building a modern progressivism that plows a hopeful path. Let's take the part where you worry about the excesses of liberalism. What are those concerns, and what are the other lessons that we've learned from a rigid anti-tax dogma?
Well, I think, you know, the excesses of liberalism is partly over-promising or not addressing the limits. And, you know, we've just run into that in Washington with the president promising people that if you like your insurance, you can keep it. Well, he should have said something like most people or something of that sort. But, you know, I think people are pretty sore about that. We've also found in Minnesota that there's a bit of an exuberance in terms of some of the taxes that were passed, particularly taxes on farm equipment and warehousing, where even the Democrats and Governor Dayton have said that they'll probably repeal those taxes in the upcoming session that starts in February.
We welcome phone calls, and here is how you reach us. Our guest this hour has written a piece that's received a lot of attention, Right versus Left in the Midwest. It's in the Sunday Review section of the New York Times. Professor Lawrence Jacobs is with us. He's been our guest on many occasions. He's a professor of political science at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota and the author of Healthcare Reform and American Politics. We're looking at the stark differences between Minnesota and Wisconsin. And what does it say about a very conservative agenda? What does it say about a very liberal agenda? Why is it that the job growth in Minnesota has been much stronger than it has in the state of Wisconsin? Are there excesses of liberalism, and are there excesses of conservatism, too, which we will ask him in a moment? Here's our number. One line is open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls. Lines are filled. Rocky is our first caller, and hi, Rocky, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
Oh, pretty good.
Good.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Rocky, go right ahead.
Oh, Okay. I'd like to ask the gentleman what the union status is in Minnesota as compared to Wisconsin as far as education. I know education had a strong backing. Our union had strong backing in the education program in Wisconsin. Is it the same thing prevalent in Minnesota?
Yes, there has been, under Governor Dayton, there's been more support for worker retraining and access to education in general. And as you may have known, the opportunity for folks who care for children in their homes or provide care for those who are functionally disabled was also established. That was a pretty controversial decision. It's not a huge number of people, somewhere between 10 and maybe a bit more than 20,000 out of a workforce of about 2.5 million.
Thanks, Rocky, for your call. Willem in Colfax, hi.
Hi. I've been self-employed business person for 30 years, and I don't think things have ever been as bad as since Governor Walker, in his own words, dropped the bomb on Wisconsin. And I think what happened was that he took so much, he took all this money out of the, you know, in his anti-union stance in Act 10, that in a small town like where I live, you know, teachers and things like that, people that worked for the DNR and all those sort of state employees lost a chunk of their income. And then it also, with his divide and conquer strategy, I think his ideology has put kind of a bad vibe, you know, I don't know what else to call it, on our state, where people aren't optimistic, people are threatened. It's very divisive, and I think all in all, that was, you know, it's a big contrast to what's happened in Minnesota. And even with the governor's support of sand mining in our state, trying to end local control and things like that, it still hasn't created a boom. And in a town like New Auburn, in a village of New Auburn, where there are three sand mining plants, there is no boom. You know, there's supposed to be an economic boom from this activity, and none of that has occurred. So I think I blame the governor for the way that he has pitted, you know, half the people against the other half of the people, the haves and the have-nots and all that sort of stuff. It's just a ideology over a practical approach, which Wisconsin used to be proud of, their education and their environmental stance and things like that. And all that has been, you know, put into this ideological war that he's on. So,
Professor Jacobs.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the core of the issue that I was trying to raise, which is, you know, we've got some folks who are very passionate about their ideas and have a fairly well-formulated philosophy about politics, and that's great, and there's a role for that. But then there's got to be a bunch of the rest of us who say, well, that's fine, but let's take a look at, you know, the data file and see how things look. And it's hard when you go into to a serious, honest look at the data. And I think in this case, it's just, it's kind of sobering. And to be honest, the more I've dug into this, the less convinced I am that this idea that if you just cut taxes, the economy will boom. It's too simple. And what's really striking about the Wisconsin case is not that long ago, there were a whole host of Republicans who were conservative, but also believed that investing in education was the future of the state's economy and way of life. I mean, someone like Tommy Thompson was a kind of a leader, a pioneer in terms of education reform.
Is there the same, I think that Willem is correct when he talks about an ideological divide. I think it's very pronounced in the state of Wisconsin. Considering that Minnesota has gone a different direction, a more liberal direction, is there an equally strong ideological divide in Minnesota?
There is absolutely ideological tensions. You know, we've got a very strong Tea Party movement. The Liberty Movement, which has grown out of Ron Paul's campaign, is also pretty strong. There's certainly a number of businesses that are upset, but I think it's not a pitched battle, in part because Republicans remain a vital force. The governor's not lionized people. It's not really his style. Mm-hmm. And Democrats have kind of taken up the banner for businesses. Plus, a number of the investments by the governor have been supported by business, including very large investments in Rochester, Minnesota, which is the home of Mayo Clinic, in order to make that kind of a global destination. A lot of support and credits have been offered to private businesses at the Mall of America, 3M, and elsewhere. So it's more of a mixed picture. And there has been a pretty concerted effort by the business community to make the case, including during Governor Pawlenty's term, that more resources, along with reform, needed to go on in the area of education, both early childhood education, K-12, and higher education. So what the Governor Dayton has talked about certainly has provoked ideological tensions, and the amount of money that was raised and that top tier are lightning rods. But it, I don't think it comes across nearly as pitched.
Right. We were doing a show on education. I can't remember what the exact topic was a few weeks ago, but we had somebody called in, and her call stayed in my mind. She was talking about her son, who had recently graduated from college, ready to go into the teaching profession, and found that Minnesota was paying something like $10,000 more per year for teachers than the state of Wisconsin. Are there those kinds of differences in salaries in teaching and in other professions between the two states?
Well, certainly in general, when you look at the higher skilled positions, Minnesota is very attractive. And while you hear some businesses and Republicans and conservatives talk about how it's going to be this flood of jobs and businesses towards Wisconsin because of the higher taxes, I think some of that will happen. But there's also probably a larger pull going the other way because we have so many Fortune 500 companies, because the pay is higher for better skilled workers, and because of just the diversity of the economy.
Mm-hmm. Willem, thanks for the call. Lines are open. 800-486-8655 is our number. We're talking with Professor Lawrence Jacobs about his piece in the New York Times Sunday Review, Right versus Left in the Midwest, comparing, which I find endlessly fascinating, Minnesota and Wisconsin. What's happened? Very different political philosophies at play since 2010. So what's happened to the business climate? What's happened to a state where the wealthy were taxed significantly higher and there's an influx of money? Where has that money gone? Compared with a state that has had a mantra of cutting taxes and very different political ideas being put into effect. So in terms of the growth of the private sector, what's happening in both of the states is the thrust of the article. Arnie in Madison is next. Hi, Arnie.
Yes, I am. Thank you for having your guest today. I'm a native Minnesotan, and I received my Ph.D. in geography from the University of Minnesota back in the 1970s. And when we were using data back then to understand, to try to understand why the Twin Cities already then was such an economic generator, it became quite clear that when compared to its other competitors in the region, it had several advantages. For example, Milwaukee, which would be its equivalent in Wisconsin, is constrained by low populations to the north, by Lake Michigan to the east, and of course by the overwhelming influence of Chicago to the south. And the Twin Cities, its hinterland, can go into western Wisconsin, into northern Iowa, and then take all of Minnesota and stretch into the Dakotas and Montana. So when one looks at banking flows, migration patterns, newspaper penetration and that, the Twin Cities really does have some advantages, and it, of course, translates into a better economy. And I just wonder if your guest thinks that perhaps some of those issues today, because the Twin Cities really is blooming, relatively speaking, if they have a role in making progressive ideas somewhat more acceptable, because simply the economy overall in the Twin Cities, and it filters out into the state as a whole, would have some role in this too.
Thanks, Arnie. Good point.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Arnie. This is exactly what I meant at the outset, which was my realization and acknowledgement in my piece that the issues I'm talking about are pretty complex and requires a good bit of more evidence and time. So everything Arnie said is correct, and I would actually add to it by talking about the nature of economic activity. Wisconsin has more reliance on older industry, whereas Minnesota, for a variety of reasons, has been developing a variety of what you might call, you know, the new knowledge economy, sorts of areas like software development or medical technology and kind of a longer list. As to why that's happening, many of the factors aren't talked about, but also investment by government. That is an element. It takes time, though, for that to play out. For a long time, it looked as if Wisconsin was really on the charge because of its investment in the new biologics, cloning, and the kind of money that was going into the University of Wisconsin at Madison.
Mm-hmm. Stem cell research,
It became a model for the country, and in fact, Minnesota went and tried to raid some of the top talent there so we could mirror it, and I'm not sure we have. One thing I would mention on this, though, is if you look back at the Pawlenty administration, here you've got a pretty conservative governor who became more conservative while he was in office, in particular as he started to think about running for president, and the pretty conservative primary voters in the presidential primaries. So he was elected and then reelected, and he was pretty opposed to new taxes, didn't allow any. There were some fees that went up. And what we saw during his term is that job growth stagnated. We actually lost a few jobs, 5,000, and we lagged behind the other states in the region and behind the country. If our job growth in Minnesota had kept up with the country, let alone leading the country, which is what we had done, we would have had about 60,000 more jobs than we ended up with. So, you know, everything Arnie said is true, but there's something in there about government policy, and particularly these smart decisions and how they play out over time.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about and contrast this with Wisconsin? You talk about in the article businesses cheering many of them, Dayton's investments in the Mayo Clinic, the Viking Stadium, the Mall of America, and 3M headquarters. Have you seen similar kinds of investments in the state of Wisconsin, and just more information about why those particular businesses were targeted for investment in Minnesota?
I was honored to have the revenue commissioners from Minnesota, Wisconsin, to my center at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota about 2 months ago. And I asked that question to Mr. Chandler, and because I was curious, and he pretty much said, this is not really an appropriate role for government. So I think this is one of those cases where we get back to that philosophy.
Mm.
And I think, you know, in some ways you could see what Governor Dayton is doing is pretty mainstream. He's trying to support business that are jobs creators. And with, you know, tax credits and infrastructure building, it's a pretty familiar and not necessarily partisan strategy, at least not until recently. But this philosophical divide, you know, I think Governor Walker on principle just doesn't think it's appropriate for government to be investing in the private sector. You know, the private sector should be doing that, and why should tax dollars or credits be used as a way to subsidize those private enterprises?
Thanks, Arnie, very much for the call. As you know, it's no secret that it would appear that the governor of Wisconsin is looking for higher office and maybe entertaining a presidential run. And I'm thinking of Tim Pawlenty, who also was entertaining a presidential run the last go around. It's striking to me that what's going on in the state, if you look at the economy in the state of Wisconsin, which really is not doing very well, and when you describe what was happening with Pawlenty in Minnesota, that when it comes to national office, those particular areas that you would think would face tough scrutiny aren't facing very tough scrutiny.
Well, you know, the key thing about the Republican presidential nomination is that it has been and will be a ferocious battle. And the key thing there is to focus on who are the people who make those decisions. And if you remember back to last year, the primary voters tend to be pretty conservative, much more conservative than rank-and-file Republicans, swing voters, and I would say the country as a whole. We've seen over the last three, four election cycles that the white evangelical voters become a larger proportion of the Republican presidential primary. And the so-called very conservative, that would be the kind of Tea Party or Libertarian type of folks. So when Governor Walker is really holding back on taxes and pulling back on spending in some of these areas we've talked about, well, I think he is in line with the heart and soul of the Republican Party as it is. The question is, if you win the nomination, can you go on and win a general election where people are probably going to be more concerned with these kind of questions about jobs and, you know, economic prosperity and some of the issues we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Al in Land O'Lakes, our next caller. Hi, Al.
Hi. How you doing?
All right. How are you?
Pretty good.
Good.
Thanks for the show. I've lived in both Wisconsin and Minnesota. My dad was actually Father Crappie's dentist back in the 60s.
Oh, really?
So I was involved, in a way, politically back then. And in the 70s, I went to Wisconsin. In the 80s, I moved to Minnesota. You know, and I want to thank Minnesota for Al Franken. And I met Jesse Ventura when I moved to Minnesota. He owned a building where a friend of mine was testing for his karate. Anyway, Jesse Ventura is a very interesting guy, as far politically, as far as that goes.
Yeah.
He was up against it and ended up quitting because of political pressure. And it's all about greed. I knew Gaylord Nelson, too, back in the 70s. Yeah, I had met him, you know. But the reason I moved to Minnesota was for taxes, for property taxes. You know, I had a farm, and they were 10 times less taxes than they would have been in Minnesota. I mean, in Wisconsin.
All right, let's take a look at the issue of property taxes. Professor Jacobs.
Well, over the last decade or so, we've seen property taxes increase in Minnesota as the local government aid was rolled back. And the Democrats in 2013 tried to reverse that, and they passed a pretty significant amount of money to reduce property taxes. The evidence that's just come in the last month or so suggests that the counties and cities have gone ahead and taken that money but also increased property taxes, which, you know, we haven't had the new session yet, but I have a hunch that with plenty of Democrats feeling like they were sandbagged because they did make an effort, and I think it was a genuine effort, to lower property taxes, and that does not appear to be happening consistently around the state, though it's probably also fair to say that the property taxes did not go up as much as they would have if the legislature hadn't taken the steps it did.
Thanks for the call. I want to go back to this $2.1 billion largest increase in recent state history in raising of taxes. How was that idea formulated? We need to raise taxes because...
What were the reasons?
Yeah.
Well, you know, clearly there was a big debate about how is Minnesota going to balance its budget. Minnesota is one of those states where you have to balance the budget each year. And the approach that had been taken under Governor Plenty had been to look for spending cuts mostly and then to raid some funds and then maybe look at some fees if that didn't work. And what Governor Dayton said is he wasn't going to continue to do that. And the Democrats, once they were elected in 2012 elections and took control of the legislature, they came in and said, okay, we're going to have to increase taxes to help close that gap, along with making some cuts in spending. What was striking, and I think even caught some Democrats kind of by surprise, was the magnitude of the increase. And there was a real sense that, you know, was this too much? Because the deficit was not nearly, you know, was half as much as this $2.1 billion. So what the governor was doing is saying, yep, we're gonna close the budget gap as we have to by the Constitution. Then we're going to make investments mostly in education And then in a few other areas.
Mm-hmm. Is anybody, I'm wondering if you are looking at or other scholars are looking at what has happened in terms of a 15% reduction in schools, the funding of K-12 schools in the state of Wisconsin. What are the effects of that?
You know, I haven't dug into the consequences of that down the line. What I could tell you is that for many years, Wisconsin was, you know, led the country or was one of the leaders in the country in terms of its spending on per student for K-12 and the support it provided for higher education. In some areas, it continues to be, you know, up there, but it's clearly not the leader it was. So the question, and I think this will be a long-term question, is if you continue to see erosion in that support for what just about everybody agrees is kind of the fountain of economic growth, that is a trained workforce and training for your entrepreneurs and your inventors, you know, what are going to be the consequences of that?
Mm-hmm. Larry Jacobs is our guest this hour of the program. Many of you have seen his piece in the New York Times Sunday Review section this past Sunday, Right versus Left in the Midwest. He is the Walter and Joan Mondale Chair for Political Studies and Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance in the Hubert Humphrey School and Department of Political Science at the University of Minnesota. And we're looking at what has happened in terms of business growth, taxes, where money has been invested with a tax hike significant in Minnesota and a Democratic administration, tax cuts, a Republican administration in the state of Wisconsin. So that's what he is exploring in the article and what we are this hour. More phone calls momentarily at 800-486-8655. Our phones have been busy. You can always send an email. We'll get to one of those in a moment, and that is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls. Elaine in Colfax is next. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I live near the border of Minnesota, and I have friends there, and I admire the intelligent and reasonable people of Minnesota. I really do. And I just think there's a kind of job that's rarely discussed, like the work of artists and musicians. And in Minnesota, there are many grants and awards for excellence for professional artists, and the cultural support benefits the whole community. The artists flourishing bring in money to restaurants, theaters, downtowns. Here in Wisconsin, the Arts Board is gone. It's just all the money is dried up, and it's bleak. And our governor has zero support for artists or any seemingly understanding of the value of artists in a community. And I'd just like your guest to comment, please.
All right. Thanks, Elaine.
This is actually one of those areas where there's been a growing body of research. And it tends to show that investing in the arts is a tool for encouraging economic growth because the so-called new economy workers tend to be drawn to areas where there are the arts, where there are kind of stimulating environments outside of the workplace. In Minnesota, we had a period during the Pliny administration when there was some support for the arts, but it was reduced. There was a referendum that created a pool of money that's been used for the arts as well as for the outdoors and hunters and fishers and so forth. So it was an interesting coalition. So there has been that public money there. There's also been a very vibrant private sector role. We recently rebuilt one of the main theaters in Minnesota, the Guthrie Theater, and it's now kind of five different stages, and it's one of the best theaters in the country. And that was driven by the private sector. We had a whole lot of our top CEOs from General Mills and elsewhere who kind of stepped up and said, yeah, this is really important to us, and we agree that it doesn't have to come from, taxpayer dollars, something that we can step up to do. Government, the state played a little bit of a role, but it was really that leadership from the private sector that was pretty important.
Here's an email from Jonathan from Appleton. It's clear that out-of-state money played a significant role in Walker's election. Was there the same kind of outside influence in Minnesota? And if so, why didn't it have the same result?
there wasn't quite as much outside money flowing into Minnesota in 2010. There was some, but not as much, partly because Republicans did not have a very good candidate. Tom Emmer had a terrible, ran a terrible campaign. He came on at the very end, but you know, a lot of Republicans feel as if he could have been the winner if he had run a competent campaign. So looking at a competent campaign and other places to put money, some of the donors just skipped the state or just didn't put in very much.
Mm-hmm. Mark, Lake Geneva, hi.
Hello.
Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, we heard the Minnesota side of what's been done in regard to the Affordable Health Care Act. I'd like to hear the Wisconsin side, too, please.
All right, Mark.
Do you want me to jump in?
Please.
Yeah, I you know, it. Scott Walker, in principle, opposes the Affordable Care Act, so he's refused to expand Medicaid, and he's passed up on the 3 years of 100% funding and the 90% of funding afterwards. His argument is that if we take this money, we're going to be on tap to then pay for it when the federal government reneges on its commitment. You know, it's not a very sympathetic argument because there are all sorts of provisions, including provisions the state could put in, that would make it very clear that the benefits would disappear if the funding disappeared. Some states have done that just so they're not caught out in the ledge. The governors also refused to expand this private health insurance market that states can do, taking advantage of the discretion that they have under the Affordable Care Act. A lot of the money for setting it up and some of the initial rollout was being picked up from the federal government. That money has not been taken by Wisconsin. It's being used for other purposes, I take it. And instead, Wisconsin's become vulnerable to what has been, at least initially, a pretty flawed federal health insurance exchange. You know, to me, it's just on a pragmatic level, quite apart from the politics. I don't understand why a state, particularly a conservative, would rather default to the federal government rather than taking responsibility, you know, at the state level, particularly because Wisconsin has been such a pioneer for so many years in the area of health care and health policy.
Well, I'm wondering about that. There are other examples of this. The governor has also been accused of being so rigid in a political ideology that he didn't take money for trains, expansion of making a regional train network through the state of Wisconsin as well. Can he be rightfully criticized, do you think, for just putting ideology over pragmatism?
Well, you know, I'm going to leave that to the political process, but I would say this. I think that you can take evidence and say, okay, Minnesota has taken this. What does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is a record there and a growing record about an exchange that's working. The Medicaid process is working. It looks pretty efficient. And the premiums that Minnesota is offering are substantially below the premiums that are now available in Wisconsin. Wisconsin folks would be saving a whole lot of money if it had adopted the state exchange and gotten some of the competitive dynamics.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, what we're finding, in some ways, it goes against the, I think, the mindset people have about the reform. We're seeing more health plans participating, and they're competing against each other. And so those premiums, in a good part of state, not everywhere, I talked about the rural problem, but on average, we're just seeing those premiums coming in lower than anywhere else in the country.
Hmm.
So that's at a pragmatic level, that's the kind of thing where I'd say, you know, let's just kind of put our thinking caps on and look at the data.
Mm-hmm. Paul in Cedarburg, hi.
Hi. Great show, great guest. I think one of the things the two states have in common is strong public radio. But I wonder if you touched on one thing, the comparison between the college graduation rates between the two states.
You know, I didn't talk about that in this piece, but it's a really good point. In Wisconsin, at least at Madison, has, you know, done better than Minnesota. Minnesota's doing a bit better, but, you know, I'm at the university. I'm very proud of the University of Minnesota, of course. But, you know, I think that's one of the areas where, you know, we've got some catching up to do. I mean, Wisconsin has got so much going for it. This is a competition among two of the smartest, best-performing states. You know, I don't think anyone's talking about comparing Minnesota and Wisconsin to Mississippi. So, you know, they go back and forth. There's a lot going on in Wisconsin that, as I've been saying, that that's admirable and helps to explain some of the success there.
Thanks, Paul, for your call. Lynn in Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen, and your guest. Governor Walker seems to be quite, he's not very transparent in his agenda. And but I think he's pretty see-through. And if we can see that, I'm wondering how doesn't that translate to business owners? And, you know, wouldn't that cause fear of moving a business to the state of Wisconsin?
Because businesses are afraid of what, Lynn?
The governor's lack of transparency.
Professor Jacobs?
Yeah, I don't know about the lack of transparency. What I found interesting is Forbes magazine, which is obviously a business magazine, very sensitive and supportive of American business and American capitalism. They've not been that impressed with Wisconsin under the governor. You know, they continually rank them, 34th, 35th, or further back in different categories for business friendliness. So there's something going on there. It might be the failure to invest in education and failure to invest in some of these business projects.
Email from Jeff, and we're getting short on time. Could you ask about Minnesota's public employee laws? His understanding, public workers in Minnesota have a right to strike but no arbitration in contract negotiations. Before Act 10, Wisconsin workers had arbitration and no right to strike. Could Governor Walker have reformed public employee laws to be more like Minnesota?
Yes, sure. I mean, there were a lot of options there. You know, in fairness to Governor Walker, some of the things he was talking about, Governor Pawlenty had entertained but couldn't get anywhere with because he was faced with a Democratic legislature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a kind of a battle going on all over the country over civil service workers, particularly for the states, well, and also the federal government, whether they're getting overpaid. It goes both ways. It's clear that the Governor Walker and Governor Dayton have diametrically opposed ideas about that. Governor Dayton sees the public workers as an asset, and you know, he's worked with them. I don't think the negotiations over wages were a giveaway, but he did negotiate, and he did expand unionization, whereas Governor Walker's more or less gone the other way.
Mm-hmm. One more quick call, Jim in Sturgeon Bay. Hi. Quickly, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
The reason why I called is I just want – are you there?
Oh, we're here.
Hello? Okay. I just wanted to say I wholeheartedly agree with the professor with the comment that he made a little while back about cutting taxes does not necessarily spur economic growth. I think one of the problems with Governor Walker is he surrounded himself with ideologues, not economists. Now, I am a progressive, but I also hold a graduate degree in economics. And one of the things that they teach you in graduate school is something called the law of diminishing returns. And I don't go through the entire explanation.
No, you can't. We have 10 seconds.
Basically, it applies to tax cuts. You know, you could cut taxes and cut taxes and cut taxes, and eventually it doesn't make any difference anymore.
Thank you, Jim, very much for your call. And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Professor Jacobs, you've stirred a lot of thought and opinions and conversation, and we thank you for that, sir.
Good to be with you again.
Thank you. We'll talk to you again. Opinion piece, in case you haven't read it, it's in the New York Times Sunday Review section this past Sunday. Professor Lawrence Jacobs, professor of political science at the Hubert Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.